Today on Maine Calling, efforts to ban books from libraries and schools. We've all heard the saying, the pen is mightier than the sword. The power of books can frighten people, enough so that they try to ban some of them from schools and public libraries. Throughout American history, certain people have disliked certain books and tried to shield children from them. But in the past 4 years, the movement to ban certain books has surged to historic levels. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we will discuss how libraries choose books in the first place, which books they often see challenged and why, and what happens next. We'll also discuss a Maine case which does not fit the same narrative as most of the other cases regarding controversial books. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling on Demand is made possible in part by Maine Farmland Trust, working with farmers to grow the future of farming and food in Maine. Learn how you can get involved at mainefarmlandtrust.org/learn. And by Maine Seacoast Mission, strengthening Maine's coastal and island communities through education, health, and support. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. This morning, the American Library Association reported its latest figures concerning efforts to ban books in America. The ALA reports a 92% increase in the number of titles targeted for censorship over the previous year, and 2022 was a record as well. What are Maine libraries experiencing, and what has been their response? That's our conversation today. Joining me for the hour, Sonia Durney, who is president of the Maine Library Association. She is also a research and teaching librarian at the University of New England and is with the American Library Association. Rich Boulay, director of the Blue Hill Public Library, and Heather Perkinson, president of the Maine Association of School Libraries. We invite you to join the conversation. Has censorship of book or banning a book been something that has come up as a topic in your community? Have you been a part of the discussion? Send an email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Sonia, as I just mentioned, new report showing an increase in the number of titles being targeted. And this is on top of a record year in 2022 and a record year in 2021. And I'm wondering if what we're seeing in Maine reflects what's going on nationally.
Yes, what we are seeing in Maine does reflect what is going on nationally. In the past few years, we've seen an increase in book bans here in Maine also, where we used to have maybe 4 or 5 attempts to censor books here in the state. Those numbers have gone up to 20 to 25. So not huge numbers, thankfully, like we're seeing in other parts of the country, but those numbers have gone up.
And so the number for last year, 2023, was about 20 or 25?
The number for 2023 was, sorry, I have my data here in front of me, was 16 total challenges, but 34 total titles challenged, which is one of the changes that we're seeing. If you look at the American Library Association data, it used to be that one person would challenge one title. And now what we're seeing is one person is maybe challenging 5, 10 or more books at a time. We've seen up to 100 in other states.
And my understanding is that these statistics may not reflect the whole picture, that libraries may not even be reporting something that's a challenge. They may think that it's a parent coming in and asking to have a book removed doesn't sort of qualify as something that you're going to be keeping a record of.
Correct. We're pretty sure these numbers are very underrepresenting what is actually happening both here in Maine and across the country.
All right. Well, I want to turn to you, Heather. A lot of this is going on in school libraries specifically, and I'm wondering if you can characterize what kinds of books are most often targeted and what age groups?
Certainly. High school level books are the most commonly challenged, but we are seeing some elementary and middle school books being challenged for sure. Anything to do with sex education, and then anything to do with LGBTQIA or BIPOC identities seems to be a target. So there is a definite pattern, and it feels when we compare what's happening in Maine to what's happening in the other states, we see the pattern replicated there as well. So it seems like it's local, but it feels to us like it's organized by a bigger group than what we're seeing just at the local level.
So it sounds to me like the books being challenged are culture war type of books, not actually political books. You're not having somebody say, please don't carry the Communist Manifesto, for example.
That's true. Yes, absolutely. When people speak at school board meetings about these books, the thing they talk about most often is whether we're hypersexualizing kids or whether the books are pornographic or whether they're obscene.
And Heather, what is the impact on school librarians? Does this have a chilling effect or does this have an emboldening effect? What's going on? When you talk to your colleagues across the state, what's their state of mind right now?
People are really, school librarians are really struggling, I would say. We find it very difficult to, we want all the children in our schools to feel welcome. And when someone attacks a book that represents a specific identity, we feel like those kids are being attacked. And so we take it very hard, and it's a very emotional, personal impact on us. And we are definitely not feeling emboldened. We are feeling harassed and attacked. And a lot of school librarians have had their pictures posted on social media with really defamatory statements made about them. So it's been really tough.
Mm. I want to turn to you, Rich, because your story is a little bit different than the story that a lot of libraries are dealing with. You received a lot of attention for a situation in which you were asked to accept a book rather than ban it. Explain to me what happened and what has happened since.
Yeah, so a patron handed me a book. He said, hey, Rich, how do I get a book on the library shelves? And I, wanting to be accommodating, said, you just hand it over. And when he handed it to me, I was a little bit dismayed to see the title. But so the title is Irreversible Damage. It's a book by Abigail Schreier, and it is a conservative perspective on transgender youth. And I looked at the book. I looked at the publicity around it. I learned that the book was well-regarded. It was a book of the year by The Economist and The Times of London, and I thought it was a missing perspective on our shelves. And so I decided to include it in our collection and had quite a bit of pushback for that. Two formal challenges were issued to challenge that decision.
And what were you hearing from your community when this was happening?
I was hearing everything under the sun. It was largely a social media controversy. A lot of really negative comments, really very unpleasant personal attacks. It became a really unfun situation.
And your story made it to national media. The New York Times wrote about it. What happened after that?
That was a kind of an amazing overdue catharsis for me. There was a journalist working on another story about the library, and to make a long story short, it wasn't really going to get into print. It wasn't going to see the light of day. And meanwhile, she started to work on a similar story to mine, although about the more typical trend of progressive LGBTQ type books being challenged, and about librarians in Tennessee and in other places in Idaho, for example, not enjoying the kind of support that I did here from, say, my board of directors. And she decided to include our story as kind of a companion to that larger article. I received over 150 emails from people all over the country, most of whom I've never met, the vast majority of whom identified as supportive of LGBTQ rights, and who also said they fully endorsed and supported the decisions that we made here at the Blue Hill Library. It was very uplifting, actually, to get that feedback.
Mm-hmm. And what about that book now? Is it on your shelves?
Well, it's checked out, actually, but it's in circulation. And that's actually something that I want to make sure to point out, which is that every single book ban that I know of backfires. Somebody who's being well-intentioned, who thinks they're protecting some vulnerable population, ends up calling more attention to the issue that they're concerned about. And that's certainly what happened here. We had more interest in the book. It got checked out more. It was read by a local book club because suddenly it was a banned book and they wanted to find out what the deal was. And also they were challenging themselves to read books that were outside of their typical kind of Overton window, if you will.
Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, though, do you think sometimes people are checking out the book to keep it off the shelf so other people can't read it?
We absolutely had defensive checkouts. Yeah, I'm pretty certain of that. In fact, after the New York Times article, we had a protest here at the library because of the renewed attention on the issue. And the protest consisting of three people and really one protester and two observers. Anyway, they wanted to check out the book, and I'm pretty certain that was to not be able to return it. But it was already in circulation, so they couldn't.
I wanted to come back to that topic that you brought up, Rich, and turn to you, Sonia, about how banning a book or censoring a book actually calls attention to it and more people read it. I see that last year, Carnegie Mellon did a study confirming that.
Yes, I'm not familiar with that study, but that definitely is a trend. I've actually seen authors shout out on X or other formats like, well, thank you for attempting to ban my book. My sales have gone up. So, and as Rich mentioned, it's so enriching to read a book that potentially is being challenged if it goes against your maybe normal point of view, because we should all be increasing the diversity of items that we're exposed to rather than just staying in our echo chambers and reading the same things over and over. So it can have some good benefits, the book challenges.
Heather, have you found, and I've read that in many cases, the people challenging books in school libraries do not even have students in those schools. And I'm wondering if that's what you have found and if this is what school librarians in Maine have been finding.
That definitely happens. We see parents of elementary school children challenging a book that isn't in the elementary school library, it might be in the high school library. But I did want to say too, although anecdotally, we've definitely seen that banning a book can backfire. For the children in the schools who identify with the book in some way, you can't undo the damage that is done to them by the challenge to the book, by taking the book away from them or by having the publicity. You know, if there's that much level of publicity that people are buying more copies of the book, that means that all those kids that identify with the book are hearing about it too and feeling attacked.
So you feel like even the discussion over a book like that, even the suggestion that book is somehow not acceptable is really affecting the mental health of young people who feel different than others.
Absolutely. And these are some of our most vulnerable children as far as mental health goes already, just because of their identities. And statistically speaking, they tend to be the most vulnerable. But getting back to your question, I think we definitely do see sometimes it's not apparent that the book is really relevant to. And, you know, we see kids and parents disagree about what the child should be reading all the time. And that's that's part of normal life. Like a library is a little bit of a microcosm of the real world. And kids need to learn that some things are okay in their family and some things are not okay in their family because of their own family's values. And so we want those discussions to happen between parent and child. And we don't want to be the one saying, your child can't read this book, and so we're not going to have it in the library. That should be a discussion that happens between the parent and the child.
I want to back up a little bit and ask you, Heather, the bigger question, because I know many school libraries are small, and this is a selection process. You have to figure out what stays and what goes, what you can have space for on the shelves. Tell me how that happens. How do you as a school librarian, how do other school librarians, what are best practices about choosing which books to keep generally?
I think some people look at my job and think that must be so much fun. You get to buy all the books you want. And it's not like that at all. You have to work really hard to think about the needs and the curriculum of your district and work within the budget that you're given. And all librarians, all school certified school librarians in Maine are required to have a master's degree. So we're highly trained professionals and we work really hard. We use reviews. We cross-reference our reviews and those reviews are written by professionals. We also work from award lists. And then, as I said, we think about, you know, what do my sophomores need for that research paper they do every year? What do my juniors need for their work and in AP language and literature? And so it's within your school budget, you're thinking about all of those things and balancing all of those things as you make those choices.
And Rich, what about for a public library in a town? Same question, I'm sure. I know that lots and lots of people donate books, especially if someone downsizes or somebody in their family dies. You're probably getting books, boxes and boxes of books all the time. How do you decide what stays on the shelf?
Well, we're swimming in books here, but we have a collection development policy that's developed in conjunction with the board of directors, the staff, and public comment certainly welcome. And it kind of acts as a letter of understanding between the town, the board, and the staff. And it identifies priorities for the collection. Here at the Blue Hill Library, we have a set of kind of criteria, which are the heart of the policy, things like public demand, authority, literary merit, critical reviews, enduring value of the content, et cetera. Scarcity of the subject matter in the collection or in the larger library network. Those are all factors that we consider when we're thinking about what books to add to the collection. And I just want to add that one of the factors that we consider isn't, do I as a librarian agree or disagree with the perspective that is being expressed in the book? In fact, we strive to collect and make available books from all points of view. And I think that every argument deserves to be examined.
Well, we do need to take a break. We are talking about book banning, about censorship, specifically in libraries. The phone number 1-800-399-3566. You can post a comment on Facebook or Instagram or send us an email, talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today's topic is book banning, why it is an issue in Maine and nationwide. With me, Rich Boulay, who is director of the Blue Hill Public Library, Heather Perkinson, president of the Maine Association of School Libraries, and Sonia Durney, who is president of the Maine Library Association. You can share your comments and questions by email, talk@mainepublic.org, comment on Facebook or Instagram, or call 1-800-399-3566. Before we get to the call, Sonia, I know you wanted to talk a little bit about a general statement, a general core value of librarians across the country.
Exactly. Yeah. So the freedom to read is a core value of libraries across the country. And I always like to make sure to point out that censorship is not new. You know, the Puritans were censoring books. There was something called the Comstock Act in the 1800s when censorship was very prevalent. They actually made an agent out of a post office worker to look for lewd pamphlets in the mail, which were generally things, sex ed sort of materials. In 1939, the Library Bill of Rights came about, and that was in part due to response to Steinbeck's Grapes of Wrath, as many of the farmers in this town were on the town council, and they were worried that the library workers might form a union after reading the book and realizing that, you know, treatment on farms was being more widely looked at. So the Library Bill of Rights came about from that. And one of the points is in that is that all points of view should be represented. So that speaks to Rich's point of how we're not trying to purchase books that reflect our own points of view. We're purchasing books that reflect all points of view based on library budget and audience and space. And then there's also the Freedom to Read statement, which came about in 1953. It was just the 70th anniversary of that, and thousands of libraries have signed on to reaffirm that. And it's just that the freedom of to read is essential to our democracy. And I feel safe saying that I think all of us librarians here on that call would agree to that statement.
We'll go down to Gibson Faye LeBlanc, who's, oh, go ahead. Gibson, hold on. Rich, go ahead.
Apologies. I just want to point out that the Freedom to Read statement was a direct response to the McCarthy era. It was adopted by the American Library Association and all kinds of publishing organizations to say, we stand for the freedom to read together.
We're going to go to Gibson Faye LeBlanc with the Maine Writers and Publishers Alliance. Hi, Gibson.
Hi, and thanks for doing this show, Jennifer. I just wanted to add a couple of things. One, that I think it's all really important for all of us who are not librarians to be supporting librarians right now. There's such a climate with the rise in book bans across the country, and we're seeing that in Maine, maybe not to the same extent, but certainly to a larger degree, a lot of book bans or challenges. And so, you know, I've heard directly from school and community librarians who are struggling, you know, with these issues. And so I just think it's really important for people in all of our communities to stand up and support their libraries and support librarians as professionals, as people who are curating these amazing collections at schools and in their communities. And you know, we can trust them to do their jobs. And I think in most cases, there's a very vocal minority of folks who are challenging, who are the people who are doing this challenging. And I guess one thing we haven't said about that is that a large portion of the challenges are directed at books that have LGBTQ themes and have themes related to race and racial justice. And so there's a very like political thing that's happening here that I think it's important to be aware of.
Gibson, I wanted to ask you, you started your comment by saying you think it's important for everybody to be supporting librarians. Other than walking into your library and saying, I appreciate you, what do you suggest that other people, what people can do?
I mean, I think get involved, right? Get libraries that have boards, get, you know, see how you might get involved, see how you might help. Ask the librarians how you can, if you can volunteer, if you have time to give, or how you can support them. You know, write letters in support of particular books if they're being challenged. You know, just sort of stand up and be heard, because I do think there's like a very small group who's trying to sort of take books away from larger groups with these bans.
All right, and I think Rich Boulay has a suggestion. Rich,
well, get a library card. It's the most important card in your wallet.
There you go. Gibson, thanks so much for calling in and joining the conversation. Gibson Faye LeBlanc is with the Maine Writers and Publishers Alliance. We're going to go to Maureen. Maureen, go ahead.
Hi, thank you so much. My name's Maureen. I work for an organization called Interfaith Alliance. So we organize people of diverse faiths and beliefs across the country to work to build a more resilient democracy, to protect religious freedom and embrace the beautiful pluralism, religious and otherwise, of this country. And that includes the work to protect public schools and libraries. And I'm so thankful to the perspective both that you all provided centering librarians, the fact that librarians are feeling attacked and harassed in trying to do the incredible thoughtful work of putting books on the shelves through the process that you guys walked us through, but also centering students. I want to emphasize that, you know, too often religion is used as a cover or a motivator for trying to limit what goes on the shelves, you know, particularly when it comes to erasing the identities and the stories of religious minority characters, of LGBTQ characters. I mean, these things don't exist in a vacuum. We're seeing the same kinds of attacks and rhetoric in our legislatures, in our school boards, in other areas of our government that are also targeting religious minorities and LGBTQ people. This stuff doesn't happen in a vacuum. And, you know, from our perspective, we think that, you know, religious communities can be really powerful places to organize and, you know, speak out. And I just want to offer that, you know, from a both a religious freedom perspective and also from a kind of moral clarity perspective, that our public schools and libraries, they are cornerstones, they are building blocks for an inclusive participatory democracy. And they are places where, you know, so unfortunately, so many students, it's the only place where they're, you know, going to be exposed to students with different people of different identities and perspectives.
Right.
And exploring matters of,
Maureen,
you know, gender.
Thank you so much for your call. Go ahead, Sonia.
I think it's wonderful to have the support of organizations that are interfaith, because it really ties in with the data that shows us that the majority of Americans don't support these book bans. We know from the American Library Association that 71% of voters oppose book bans. And what's also surprising is when they break it down by party, it's 75% Democrat and 70% of Republicans don't oppose book bans also, which I feel like the common conversation is that it's Republicans are opposed to these books, but it's really, you know, the extremists, the majority of Americans oppose book banning.
Maureen, thanks for your call. Joining us now is Sunny Dean, who is a Maine-based children's book author and illustrator. Thanks so much for calling in, Sunny.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and I'm calling, Sunny, to tell me, to have you tell us about your experience as a children's book author. What are your books about, and what kind of resistance have you encountered?
Definitely a lot of resistance. I write children's books for younger children, preschool, kindergarten age group, and I've written books on some pretty tough topics. I've tackled things like the Stonewall Uprising and vaccines, but in a very non-controversial way. I mean, the book about Stonewall is about shapes and colors and being different, and that different is good. If it didn't have the word Stonewall in it, you would have no idea it was about that. The book that I wrote about vaccination talks about how horrible something like polio is and how vaccines work to prevent it. So ultimately, the books are very appropriate, age-appropriate for the children, but they have been the target of bans in a number of states, fortunately not Maine. But I think the hardest part is the chilling effect that it has, where so many school libraries and teachers are just struggling with, you know, underfunding and just not enough hours in the day, and they just want to avoid that whole mess. They know that when they put a certain book on the shelf, whether it's from an LGBTQ author like me or a subject like this, they're going to get some flack. And I think a lot of the schools that are around in Maine that I've tried to work with, they just don't want to go through anything even vaguely controversial because they just don't want the headache.
Can you tell us a story, Sunny, about an example of something that's happened with your books?
Definitely. We've run into this several times where my publishers tried to donate books, and I've tried to do activities with kids in school. And unfortunately, one particular case was when there was a school that was very resource limited in down East Maine. They asked for a donation of books for several classes and a classroom visit for three grades, where the kids would work with me on putting ideas into their own books and then actually writing a book of their own. I wrote an inscription in every single book so that kid would have something encouraging, a personal note from an author. I worked really hard on the preparation. At the last minute, they canceled the visit without any explanation. I found out after the fact that every single book was thrown in the dumpster before any child ever even saw them, because one teacher objected to a child in the book having two fathers. It wasn't even the point of the book, but somehow that kid having two fathers read her a bedtime story was so objectionable that they'd rather deny every single one of those kids the experience of working with an author and illustrator. And I think that just has such a horrible effect. You know, every kid in this country right now is hearing these attacks on LGBTQ people for just existing. And I know what that felt like as a kid, but it's so much worse now.
Sunny, I'm so sorry to hear that story. I wanted to ask you what you think would be a better course of action if one parent or one teacher is concerned. What do you think ought to have happened?
I think that there can be a dialogue if they actually read the books rather than just look at one thing and say, that's it. But I think, you know, if there's a parent who objects to their child reading a book, that's one thing. But you can't deny it to every single kid just because you have an objection. And I don't think there's any reason to ever object to a book that just shows, you know, two fathers existing. You know, having two fathers having a daughter reading a book, I mean, denying people the right to exist and be represented in literature is just horrific. That's not what this country's about.
Sunny, I'm going to keep you on the line. I'm going to go back to you, Heather, and ask you if you feel as though what's going on in with these parents and teachers, in some cases teachers objecting, if you believe it's having a chilling effect in some school districts.
As far as, yes, it definitely is. I mean, you know, librarians never imagined that we would be in this position and having to fight this way. This was not what we signed up for. And it is, you know, I had a student tell a story, a BIPOC student say that she's not a big reader, but she spends a lot of time in my library and she looks around and she sees the identities represented on the covers of the books. And it tells her that this is a safe space for her. And that's hugely important. She says, you know, especially in her school and in many communities in Maine, she is one of just a handful of BIPOC students. And so there are very few people like her around her. So when she sees those faces on those book covers, it means a lot to her. So the representation in literature really does matter and makes a huge difference for kids.
Sunny, I have to ask you, has this had a chilling effect on you? Have you thought twice about what your next book will be about?
It actually has the opposite effect on me, I think, because I know what it felt like to be that kid that didn't see themselves represented. And, you know, I grew up in rural Vermont and looked around and really felt like I was the only person like me in the world. I mean, I knew that couldn't be the case, but I feel so strongly that it is so important to keep doing what I'm doing. It certainly does have an effect on book sales. And, you know, I'm not going to lie. I certainly struggle with, you know, just how miserable it feels when you get death threats. But my thought is, fine, bring it on. Give it to me instead of the poor kid sitting in a classroom wondering if, you know, if they're going to be okay and just trying to make it through to adulthood.
Well, Sunny, thank you so much for calling in. That was a Maine-based children's book author and illustrator, Sunny Dean. What is your experience with books that are controversial? Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. If you're quick, you can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org or find us on Facebook or Instagram. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. What makes certain books controversial, and how are libraries dealing with pushback against some books? My guest today, Heather Perkinson with the Maine Association of School Libraries, Sonia Durney with the Maine Library Association and the American Library Association, and Rich Boulay with the Blue Hill Public Library. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org or post to our Facebook page or to Instagram. We'll go up to Camden and Beatty. Hi, Beatty. Go ahead.
Yes, I had a sort of off-the-wall reaction to hearing about the Freedom to Read Act. And I was thinking of all the people who don't read very well or not at all. And they try not to confess it and try to hide it. And I had this sort of idea perhaps libraries could offer or connect reading helpers with people. I think that there's a mismatch. A lot of the banning books is from people who probably don't even read books very much. And then I think of prison populations, of course, that are full of people who pretend that they don't let it be known that they don't read. And this
Beatty, thank you for your call. And Sonia, I'll let you address that, literacy efforts through libraries.
Yeah, there are many, many literacy efforts through libraries. We believe there's books for all readers. So there are certainly audiobooks. There are talking book programs. The Maine State Library can mail some of these items to people's homes. There are books in prisons, but and some libraries do have sort of literacy groups to work on literacy. There are programs for new Mainers to work on English skills. There are all sorts of library programs going on, and audiobooks in various formats too, in addition to ebooks, right? So I mentioned ebooks that you can, you know, get an app on your phone and stream them, but there's also CDs you can get through the mail. There's lots of materials available. I definitely recommend reaching out to either your local library or the Maine State Library.
Thanks, Beatty, for your call. An email here from Rob. Rob writes, librarians are the new superheroes in my view. Thank you for protecting freedom of ideas in America, a foundational principle for our nation and future. So thank you for that email, Rob. And, you know, I wanted to ask you again, Sonia, we asked Gibson Faye LeBlanc this question. What can regular people do to get involved in this issue?
Yeah, there's so much people can do. Rich mentioned just getting a library card. Beyond that, if you're feeling really inspired, I highly encourage people to sign up for Unite Against Book Bans. It's a wonderful website where you can get updates on what is happening. That's where that new data came out today on the book banning. Also, they'll send you alerts, and there's a wonderful tool on there called the book resume. So if you're a parent, maybe looking at a book on why it's being banned, there's lots of information there on what the book's about, what sort of awards it's won, why it's being flagged. So it can give you a lot more information on why this may or may not be a good book for your family. And the last thing I would say is, I mentioned before, I feel a lot of these challenges are coming from just sort of extreme sides of partisan issues. The more we can all talk civilly with each other and have conversations like we're having here today, I think the better off we'll all be. And just recognizing that there is a reader for every book and a book for every reader, but we don't all have to read all of the books.
Rich, you know, I think some of the people, if not all, some of the people who are challenging books do have sincerely held beliefs, and they don't want their children to be exposed to ideas at too young of an age. And I'm wondering what you think about that argument for keeping some books off shelves.
I don't think that's an argument for keeping things off shelves. I think that's an argument for parents being involved with their children's reading choices. I think that's really critical. When you come to a public library, you typically have free rein over where any material that's in the library, regardless of your age. We don't, if a child brings a challenging or, you know, explicit book to the shelf to check out, we don't say to them, you can't borrow that. In the wake of the New York Times article, I got a really great message from one parent and patron. And her notion is that you can protect people too much and they become a candle that is easily extinguished by a puff of air, or we can feed them with fuel and turn them into a wildfire that is driven forward by gusting winds. And she said she wants her kids to be wildfires. She doesn't want their ideology to be so fragile and weak that it can't handle opposing ideas. I just thought that was so beautiful when she shared that with me.
Heather, and you think there might be something bigger going on here?
I do. I think we're being distracted from our real job. I think that these attacks on school libraries in particular are really about the very essence of public education and what it means. And it is a crucial part of our democracy and a place where children can learn about their world and about each other and can be exposed to other children from all walks of life and all identities. And I think the really chilling thing is the attack on public education.
We'll go to Jack, who's calling from Kittery. Hi, Jack, go ahead.
Yes, can you hear me? I'm sorry.
Yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm just trying to pull off the road. So I was just, as I've been listening to the show, and I heard about the organization, I think it's called, you know, banning books, and this is a question for the person from the librarian. My question is what books, if any, should be banned? Like, what would be the criteria for actually banning a book, at least in, from her point of view?
And Jack, are you asking about a public library in a town or a school library?
As I've been listening to the show, I've been thinking more primarily about school libraries. So what should be banned? We're talking about, it just feels like the show is more about, we shouldn't be banning books. But then I thought to myself, well, is that really true? And if we should be banning books, well, what would be the criteria of the books that we should be banning?
So Heather, I'll let you talk about that. What are books that don't belong on school library shelves?
There are plenty of books that don't belong on school library shelves. School libraries are small libraries. They're not public libraries. We have our own budgets and our own curriculums that drive what belongs there. But there are, and they are usually separated by grade spans. Although, you know, I have, in my library, I have 9th through 12th grades. And if you know a 14-year-old and an 18-year-old, you know that those are very different people with different interests and developmental needs. And so I would say there are definitely some things that I wouldn't buy for my library. And I know there are things that my middle school colleagues and elementary school colleagues won't buy for their libraries. But I would go back to the, you know, there are always gonna be books in the library that you don't want to read. And there are going to be some books that you don't agree with. And that is the nature of a library, just like it's the nature of a free country, that there are a variety of things and viewpoints available to us.
And Sonia, why don't you talk more broadly about what books might not be allowed in a public library generally?
Sure. Yeah. So there definitely are books that libraries try to stay away from. We try not to have any nonfiction books on the shelf that are straight up misinformation, because that could be harmful for a variety of reasons. There's also called a test called the Miller test, which came out of a court case in California that sort of defines obscenity. So it's a 3-pronged test, really looking at whether the work taken as a whole, so not just like pulling one or two pages out that you want to show at the local town board meeting, but looking at the book as a whole and whether it lacks serious literary, artistic, political, or scientific value, whether the book is patently offensive, and whether as a whole, its main point is to appeal to the prurient interest. So you take all of those factors together. And what we're seeing is many of these book challenges in libraries, they're applying the Miller test and finding that even some of the most challenged books do not meet this. So we've had court case after court case back that up across the country.
So, Jack, good question. Thank you. We're going to move on to Grand Falls in New Brunswick, Canada. And Andrew. Hi, Andrew. Go ahead.
Hi. Well, you know, I just wanted to say that, you know, over here on this side, the perception, how can you have a democracy without providing all available information to the people? It seems to me quite hypocritical that those who decry their freedom are so quick to ban what they disagree with. The hypocrisy or the hypocrisy of it all is astounding, actually, and it's disconcerting. It's disconcerting that sexuality and gender has been politicized, that it's been thrust into libraries, that it's denied children the very information and comfort of in their existence. And then on top of it, to know that there were 2 trans kids murdered recently in schools, there's something fundamentally wrong with these people who are crying for these undemocratic
Andrew, I was going to ask you if you're not seeing these efforts in Canada, but I do see that even though it is to a smaller extent, it is also happening in Canada where people are challenging books. Have you been following that?
Hello?
Oh, shoot. Sounds like Andrew can't hear us. But Sonia, you were nodding when Andrew was talking, agreeing with what he was saying.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely is a concern. It could be a slippery slope to government censorship and the erosion of freedom of expression. And another concerning trend we haven't really had time to talk about is that we're also seeing a lot of legislation in states looking at also trying to limit access to materials. We saw this here in Maine, in the last session, there was LD 123, which was looking to criminalize public school employees who brought obscene materials, I'm using air quotes as I say obscene, into the classroom. That bill did not pass, but it's coming from parents at the school board level, community members at the public libraries, and it's also coming up in legislation and bills across the country.
Rich, I wanted to ask you about the practical implications of what happened at the Blue Hill Library when somebody donated a book that was controversial and it was a conservative book. Have you had a surge in books that come from one perspective or another being donated to the library, people who really want to have a certain voice on your shelves?
No, I don't think that doesn't happen very often at this library anyway.
Oh, interesting. So, despite the publicity, despite the national publicity, things are pretty much the same as they were before.
I guess you could say that. Yeah. Yeah.
All right. And Heather, I wanted to ask you if there is, you've talked about what happens for school librarians, the threats, the fear. And this has been a story that's been unfolding now for, as far as I can tell, about 4 years, when it's really increased in the number of challenges that are going on. Have you all been able to develop some sort of toolbook, some sort of guidelines for school librarians who find themselves in this situation that they never would have imagined themselves to be in?
Well, we are a pretty close-knit group. I mean, Maine's a small town, so we do stick together and talk to each other and try and support each other as much as we can. And we do have a lot of support from the American Library Association as well. And we have some support from the state level, in that we all our school districts have really good policies that allow people to challenge books that they don't agree with, and they are all well-written policies. It's a requirement that each school district have a policy for challenging a book and for outlining the decisions, the criteria for the decisions you make when you purchase and discard books. So, we rely on those.
I have an email here from Mike. Should libraries be doing more programs on what the First Amendment means, discussion groups, or practicing civil discourse? Sonia, this is happening, isn't it?
It is, yeah. We are seeing a lot of libraries hold programs on civil discourse. And that's actually, we have our annual library conference coming up, and that we're going to do a whole half day workshop on enabling librarians to hold community conversations, whether it's about book censorship or other topics, because libraries are a nonpartisan space where all of our communities should be able to come together and discuss the issues that are impacting our communities. So having librarians able to lead those conversations, I think, is a boon for the whole community.
An email from Steve, and Steve reflects what our caller from New Brunswick says. I'm sad that many folks I have heard calling for book bans are also the most vocal about freedom of speech, especially freedom to support things that they most support. And Rich, you learned firsthand about the challenges of talking about freedom of speech, that we like to think that it's only one side of the political aisle that's uncomfortable with freedom of speech, but that really is not the case.
It's not, and I, when you asked earlier about what people can do to support their libraries, one thing related to this question is, if you want to support a library, make sure that you support them not just when you agree with the ideas that are being discussed, but so trust your libraries to be making good faith decisions about material selections, and that they don't have a political agenda with what they're choosing, that they're trying to choose what's in the best interest in the overall community. So it definitely, I would say the thing that happened in Blue Hill is the anomaly to the larger national trend, but it does happen to both sides. And I heard from many colleagues from around the country after the New York Times article who had experienced circumstances similar to mine.
Well, I want to thank you all for being with us for this hour. The voice you just heard, Rich Boulay, who is director of the Blue Hill Public Library. Also with us, Sonia Durney, president of the Maine Library Association, who is a research and teaching librarian at the University of New England. And Heather Perkinson, president of the Maine Association of School Libraries. Today's sound engineer was Sam Tracy. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. We have a weekly newsletter. You can sign up for it at mainecalling.org. And right now, if you sign up, you are entered to win a mystery book bundle. We receive so many books here, the Maine Calling producers and myself, and we've bundled up some and are sending them to people who sign up for the newsletter at mainecalling.org. Tomorrow on the program, learn all about alpacas, how to raise them, why they're so popular, and what role they play in Maine. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and you've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.